The captured and missing would not be forgotten or abandoned. In 1958, when CIA pilot Alan Pope was a prisoner in Indonesia, the agency came up with an audacious plan for his rescue. Intelligence determined Pope was being held in a remote jungle region of Indonesia under house arrest. Although he had relative freedom of movement in the general area, there was little chance for him to survive an escape through the jungle. TSS hit upon the idea of a portable inflatable aircraft. With the help of the Goodyear Company, TSS designed a small rubber plane that could be bundled and airdropped into a jungle clearing. All Pope would need to do was add water to special pellets inside the bundle, and a chemical reaction would produce enough gas to inflate the plane. We tested it, and it worked out pretty good. But we got ready to run it to him, and somebody, politics I suppose, canceled the operation, recalled Jameson. As clever as it was, I don't believe the aircraft was ever used operationally. The CIA eventually used a submarine to insert two of its paramilitary officers on the Indonesian coast. They went into the jungle, located Pope, and walked him out to safety, and the rubber airplane faded into agency lore. "We put it in a warehouse where it stayed for years," Jameson recalled. "One day there was some operation, and I said, 'I think we can solve this with that rubber airplane.' But when we went to the warehouse, we found the rubber was all dried up and cracked. Nobody had maintained it. So we threw it away." Another extraction device considered for Pope was the skyhook, an invention of Robert E. Fulton, who envisioned that an airplane outfitted with a hook dangling beneath it could safely snatch a suitably harnessed individual from the ground. Fulton's inspiration, the All-American system, traced its origins to a mail recovery technique from the 1920s in which pilots snagged mail pouches suspended between two poles and winched them into the airplane. An attempt by the U.S. military during World War II to modify the technique was only partially successful. In July 1943 tests by the Army Air Force, instrumented containers were extracted from the ground by aircraft, which recorded accelerations following the pickup in excess of 17 Gs, far more than the human body could tolerate. Changes in the pickup line and modifications in the parachute harness eventually brought this down to a more acceptable 7 Gs. The first live test, with a sheep, failed when the harness twisted and strangled the animal. During subsequent tests, the sheep survived. Lieutenant Alex Doster, a paratrooper, volunteered for the first human pickup. On September 5, 1943, after a Stinson engaged the transfer rope at 125 miles per hour, Doster was yanked vertically off the ground and soared behind the aircraft. Later, Fulton began experiments that would lead to the skyhook in 1950 by devising a harness that could hold either a person or cargo attached to 500 feet of braided nylon rope. The rope was lifted into the air by a large balloon filled from a small bottle of helium. Once airborne, the rope could be snatched by an aircraft equipped with two steel horns that automatically locked it into place and released the balloon. As the line was pulled tight, it would glide past the side door of the fuselage. Crewmen, standing in an open hatch, could then attach the line to a winch as the front lock was released, and pull in the rescued pilot or agent to safety. Over the next few years, Fulton refined the system. Using a Navy P-2V for the pickups, he gradually increased the weight of the pickup until the line began to break. A braided nylon line with test strength of 4,000 pounds solved the problem, but early experiments met with mixed results. In one instance, a test pig was picked up successfully. Flown through the air at 125 miles per hour, the pig arrived inside the plane unharmed, but expressed displeasure with the experience by attacking crew members. Human volunteers testing the system returned to the aircraft in considerably better spirits, and John Wayne brought the device public fame in the movie The Green Berets. The skyhook became a favorite among special forces as a test of courage. One Special Forces officer, a parachute rigger who had made more than 5,000 jumps, was said to enjoy flying alongside the aircraft Superman-style for extended periods before being reeled in. In one instance, now legendary among the Special Forces, The pilot of a plane about to pick up a high-ranking officer testing the system slowed his airspeed in an attempt to give the officer a gentler ride, but only succeeded in bouncing him along the ground, breaking numerous bones. An intelligence requirement for Skyhook came in 1961, after the Soviets were forced to abandon a suspected submarine monitoring station in the Arctic Ocean because the facility's ice runway was collapsing. In one of the Skyhook's few operational deployments, two officers from the Navy and Air Force were selected for the mission, appropriately codenamed Operation Cold Feet. They would be dropped by parachute, spending 72 hours at the station, floating in the Arctic, assessing and collecting items of intelligence value. Skyhook would then pluck them from the ice, along with photographs, papers, and whatever else they discovered on the abandoned facility. The officers landed as planned on the ice and collected 100 pounds of intelligence materials from the station. With the collection mission completed, the first intelligence officer picked up by Skyhook was dragged 300 feet by wind blowing the balloon before the plane hooked onto it. When the second investigator inflated the pickup balloon, he held on tightly to a piece of equipment on the ground to avoid being dragged. Eventually, both men were safely skyhooked into the airplane, bringing information that confirmed the facility was a submarine monitoring station. Every day, Brian Lipton arrived at 0800 hours for work at the agency and departed at 1700 hours, or earlier if he had a late afternoon softball game. Lipton, a member of Gottlieb's cadre of university-trained chemists hired in the mid-1960s, seemed like a good fit with TSD. He shouldered a heavy workload, was amiable, and always put in a full day's work. Few of his colleagues suspected Lipton led a double life inside his primary CIA cover. At night, after the parking lot and the offices of TSD's South Building headquarters emptied, Lipton returned to his office alone. There, behind a locked door, he worked on one of the most closely held projects of the Vietnam War era, creating covert communication systems for U.S. prisoners of war in North Vietnam. For the POWs who were isolated, inundated with propaganda, and subjected to continuous physical and psychological torture, these covert communications were often their only link to the outside. Confirmation to the beleaguered POWs that the U.S. government knew they were alive gave hope, and for many, enabled them to hang on. The communications were also a means for the U.S. government to identify who was alive, detail their living conditions and treatment, and possibly plan rescue missions. As a new TSD officer, I initially thought this was the kind of stuff that happened every day. A person is called in and gets assigned an important and super-secret job, said Lipton. We understood there were many things going on up and down the hall that you didn't know about. It wasn't until later, when we started to see successes, that I appreciated how valuable the work was. The project traced its origins to a single POW, Navy Captain James B. Stockdale. Shot down over North Vietnam on September 9, 1965, Stockdale at first used letters from prison to his wife, Sybil, to communicate the last names of fellow prisoners, employing a simple code, uncharacteristically referencing several football mates from his class at the U.S. Naval Academy. In fact, the three men had not played football with Stockdale, but their last names were the same as missing aviators from his squadron, whose status was then unknown. U.S. Naval Intelligence was presented with the information and afterward asked for Sybil Stockdale's cooperation in sending a secret message to her husband using a special picture. Preparing the first images took weeks, but Sybil began by including a photograph in the one letter her husband was allowed to receive each month. The photograph of the month ploy was designed to create a routine pattern of the correspondence, so the special photo would not be alerting to North Vietnamese censors. In the fall of 1966, the special photo was ready, and Sybil devised text in the letter that secretly instructed her husband to submerge the picture in water. Once soaked, the photograph's layers would separate, allowing her husband to read an enclosed message. Sybil's signal involved a photo of a stand-in for her mother-in-law, shown enjoying herself in the ocean. Sybil knew that her husband would immediately recognize the woman was not his mother. Sybil's two letters reached Stockdale just before Christmas of 1966 and were handed to him during a filmed North Vietnamese propaganda session intended to show the humane treatment of American POWs. Stockdale instantly knew the photograph was not of his mother, but remained puzzled as to why his wife sent it. Several days after Christmas, in a moment of frustration, he decided to destroy the photo, then thought, "It's dumb to throw away something from the States without doing more with it. James Bond would soak it in piss and see if something came out." Stockdale's middle name actually was Bond. In the few minutes of privacy before the guards made their next rounds, Stockdale filled his drinking cup with urine and stuck the picture inside. After a half hour, nothing happened, other than the cheesy Polaroid paper started to fray at the edge. When he pulled at the edge and separated the two white pieces of the photo, he began to see small specks emerge. Suddenly, an entire paragraph appeared on a decal-like thing on the inside of the photo paper. With only seconds before the guards arrived, he tried to memorize the message, which read, "The letter in the envelope with this picture is written on invisible carbon. All future letters bearing an odd date will be in invisible carbon. Use after you write a letter. Put your letter on hard surface, carbon on top, and copy paper on top of that. Write message on copy paper with firm pressure, but not enough to indent papers below. Best to write invisible messages in lines perpendicular to lines of plain language of letter home. Use stylus directly in invisible carbon if copy paper not available. A piece of invisible carbon can be used many times. Begin each carboned letter with "darling" and end with "your adoring husband." Be careful. Being caught using carbon paper could lead to espionage charges. Soak any picture with a rose on it. Hang on. Stockdale's first priority was to construct a list of the names of every POW known to be alive and send it back to the people in intelligence. On January 2, 1967, he prepared his first letter containing 40 names of confirmed POWs using the carbon technique along with the "darling, adoring husband" phrases. The message was then unknowingly returned to the United States by a leftist anti-Vietnam organization named Women Strike for Peace. 2 weeks later, another opportunity to communicate arose when Reverend Musty, a Presbyterian minister and frequent Hanoi visitor, passed through and offered to take mail back with him. Stockdale used the carbons for a second secret message, adding more names of confirmed POWs, along with information on the camp's location and a list of potential nearby targets. Its secret writing, when developed, revealed ominous content. "Experts in torture. Hand and leg irons, 16 hours a day." Commander Robert Burrows of Naval Intelligence, who worked with Sybil, attempted to expand communications with other POWs, but the project stalled. One agency officer who became aware of the project later on said, "What I understood was that more senior Pentagon officers took the position, 'Absolutely not. These guys have got it tough enough right now. They're being tortured to death. They're in the most miserable situation in the world. The last thing we need to do is make them spies." At that point, the Navy turned to the CIA. "It's my understanding that after the Pentagon decided not to continue communicating covertly with Stockdale, the Navy decided to do it under the table because they believed their guys needed it. They also had a senior pilot, Stockdale, who asked for it," said a TSD officer who served at the time. "The Navy request came in from outside the normal chain of command, but we had a director or deputy director who accepted their request, and TSD was directed to assist." Unfortunately, there had also been private attempts by some of the families of POWs to communicate clandestinely with their loved ones. In one well-meaning but failed effort, the wife of a POW secreted a transistor radio in a jar of peanut butter without telling anyone. The North Vietnamese guard stole the peanut butter for their own use and discovered the radio, leading to thorough searches of all packaged material. For example, candy bars were crushed into small pieces and toothpaste tubes squeezed empty before being given to prisoners. Then, in April of 1967, Commander Burroughs instructed Sybil to an expert from Washington, Bruce Rounds, from the State Department. Sybil recalled the way Rounds laughed when he said he was a state employee. It made her think he really worked for the CIA. Rounds suggested a new code that would allow Stockdale to communicate even if guards were dictating each word he wrote. Rounds taught Sybil the code, which she then used in a May 25, 1967 letter that included a photograph of the roses she received on Mother's Day. The picture with the roses was intended to be soaked. 14 months passed before Stockdale was allowed to send another letter. He inserted a phrase of special interest. "I often think of Red and wanted to include a message, but it is impossible. Tell him next time." His reference to Red alerted the intelligence community that he was unable to send a covert message. Red was retired Vice Admiral William F. Red Rayburn, who, until June of 1966, had been Director of Central Intelligence. As more letters with coded information were received, the few people who knew about the project were hard-pressed to explain how they were getting access to POW information, such as prisoner names and camp locations. Over the time that I worked at night on the project, I had the deeply satisfying personal pleasure of seeing how grateful the military was that they had this channel. For years, it had been unknown what happened to many of the guys, whether they were KIA or MIA or POWs, said Lipton. After we had the communications link, not only did the military know, but a lot of these families also began to get reliable information about their sons, fathers, and husbands. After Stockdale and the other POWs were released in 1973, and books began to be written about their experiences, concern mounted that the closely held secret methods of communication would be exposed. Word reached DCI William Casey that Stockdale intended to include a detailed account of the covert communications in his autobiography and a subsequent movie starring James Woods. Stockdale, now retired from the Navy as a Rear Admiral and awarded the Medal of Honor, seemed determined to write about POW communications. He reasoned that since the war was over, secrecy surrounding the covert channels was no longer necessary. The agency told Stockdale, "You can't do this," Lipton remembered, and Stockdale said, "The hell I can't. What are you going to do, court-martial me?" With negotiations mired, Lipton offered to visit Stockdale. Along with an agency lawyer, he met the retired admiral at his Southern California home in a face-to-face attempt to dissuade him from revealing the POW secrets. "It was a very hostile environment when we walked in. Electric, fiery," Lipton recalled. "It took 2 hours, but we convinced him to remove the most sensitive references to our capabilities. Then he bought us lunch at the Hotel Del Coronado." Back in Washington, Lipton and the lawyer went directly to Casey's office. "I don't know how you did it," the DCI said. "I couldn't, but you did. Congratulations, and thanks." For his work that made secret communications possible, an association of American POWs called NAM-POWs, Inc., declared Lipton an honorary member and prisoner of war in Vietnam. Lipton remembered his first POW reunion. "A heck of a lot of guys came up to me and said, 'I wouldn't be alive today if it wasn't for what the CIA did. That's what kept me going. That's how I was able to go in and work all night long, then come back and work the next day. I knew that we were doing things that really made a difference. Not only in military value, but for those warriors and their families.'" The U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam did not end OTS's involvement in covert warfare. President Reagan and DCI William Casey believed that Central America was in danger of falling under the influence of communist, pro-Soviet regimes in the early 1980s. The leftist Sandinista government that came to power in Nicaragua in July of 1979 bore troubling similarities to Castro's Cuba. The five-member junta ruling the country after overthrowing the former leader, Anastasio Somoza, almost immediately established close ties with the Soviet Union and began building up military forces. The Sandinistas had an estimated 5,000 guerrilla fighters in 1979, a number that quickly grew to an army of 70,000 troops by 1982. American satellite photography also showed an expanding military infrastructure, with 36 new bases constructed in rapid succession. Sandinista pilots were training to fly advanced Soviet MiG aircraft, and the army was being equipped with Soviet tanks and artillery. The effect of another Marxist government in the Western Hemisphere suggested a breach in the U.S. policy of containment and the potential to destabilize pro-American governments in nearby countries such as El Salvador. U.S. intelligence reported weapons flowing to the El Salvadorian guerrillas through Nicaragua. Reagan and Casey agreed that CIA covert operations should be part of the strategy to thwart Soviet Marxist ambitions in Latin America. Under Casey, reconstituting the CIA's covert action infrastructure, dismantled after Vietnam, became a priority. Casey decided to visit one of the OTS's newly upgraded facilities for training of foreign counterinsurgency teams and target analysis. Jameson and Parr acted as hosts. Casey sat with several OTS special missions officers until 3 a.m, drinking beer and planning the CIA's action in Central America, said Parr. Jameson prepared an analysis of how he believed the agency could effectively counter problems caused by the Sandinistas in countries around Nicaragua. It became a loud and raucous evening with Casey's encouragement and participation. He was interested in the special weapons, explosives expertise, and training OTS could bring to the problem. Impressed by Jameson's analysis, the DCI concluded the evening by saying he had the funds and directed OTS to expand its training capabilities. In early 1984, the CIA, acting on a classified authorization from President Reagan, began mining selected Nicaraguan harbors in an attempt to disrupt the country's economy. The DO tasked OTS to develop, test, and produce special mines that could not be traced back to the CIA or U.S. military suppliers. OTS engineers used 30-inch sections of 10-inch diameter industrial sewer pipe, and C4 explosive was tamped into the pipes with Louisville Slugger baseball bats. The mines used the military Mark 36 impact fuse system triggered by hull pressure, magnetics, or the sound of a ship passing overhead. The techs also installed a self-destruct capability set for varying times, depending on the anticipated length of the operation. An initial plan to airdrop the mines was abandoned when the operational managers decided that parachutes floating downward failed the covertness test. As an alternative, the CIA used high-speed boats launched from a mothership positioned in international waters to lay the mines. The ocean-going racing vessels, called cigarette boats, obtained courtesy of the U.S. Customs Service, which had confiscated them in drug busts. OTS engineers modified the boats for paramilitary operations by adding superstructure to accommodate 25mm chain guns powerful enough to penetrate tank armor. They also increased the boat's speed to greater than 60 knots, assuring a rapid withdrawal after launching an attack. Between February and April of 1984, as many as 70 mines were planted in the harbors on both the Atlantic and Pacific coasts of Nicaragua. Several ships were hit, including Dutch, Japanese, and Russian vessels. The mines created a loud noise, caused some limited damage to the ship's structures, and killed no one. Nevertheless, after becoming aware of the mines, a number of merchant ship pilots refused to sail into Nicaraguan ports, and secret intelligence reporting indicated the Sandinista government was preparing for negotiations to stop the mining. However, in early April, the mining operation became public knowledge, followed by a political uproar. Senator Barry Goldwater, chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, sent DCI Casey a blistering letter on April 9th, accusing the agency of failing to inform him of the operation. Goldwater's assertion was in dispute, but the public furor in Washington could not be contained. The intense reaction to the secret mining led to a U.S. Senate 84-12 vote passing a resolution that condemned the CIA's actions. While the resolution was not legally binding, the Reagan administration bowed to the will of Congress and ended the operation in Nicaragua. Oh boy, there was this hue and cry about mining neutral waters and acts of war. The Navy and Congress both got their noses out of joint, remembered Parr. They'd, congressional leaders, all been briefed, but some conveniently forgot that when the crap hit the fan. Through its first 35 years, OTS officers, in response to policy directives of Republican and Democratic presidents, supported covert military and paramilitary operations in Cuba, Vietnam, Laos, and Central America. Over the next two decades, many of these same officers would be called again into harm's way in Iraq, Africa, and Afghanistan. Chapter 18. Con Men, Fabricators, and Forgers. The Americans were rookies. They never learned to lie as well as we. Oleg Kalugin, retired KGB Major General. Jean Bedel Bokassa, leader of the Central African Empire, was harboring a grudge against the United States. It was 1972, and Bokassa had in his possession documents written on what he assumed was official U.S. government letterhead, alleging a plot to take control of his country. Already distrustful of colonialists and imperialists, Bokassa now had what he believed to be proof of his grim suspicions. In reality, the United States had little interest in Bokassa or taking over the former French colony. Located between Chad and the Congo, the Central African Empire, later to be renamed the Central African Republic, was an uninviting piece of real estate, even for a developing country. Although containing some uranium deposits, the impoverished country consisted primarily of subsistence farmers, limited industry, and poor roads. Bokassa, although a particularly unpleasant head of state, was primarily a survivor. As a French legionnaire, he had survived one of the bloodiest battles in Vietnam at Dien Bien Phu, earning himself France's Croix de Guerre and membership in the Légion d'Honneur. Returning to Africa a war hero, Bokassa headed his young country's armed forces before staging the military coup that landed him in the presidential palace in 1965. Once in power, he began bestowing on himself a series of increasingly grandiose titles, starting with President and Prime Minister, and then President for life. Intent on holding control of the country, Bokassa showed little patience for dissidents, sometimes by throwing them to the crocodiles. In 1979, he would outrage the world by imprisoning and executing schoolchildren who dared to protest the new mandatory school uniforms. Designed and sold by Bokassa's wife, the elaborate uniforms were both too hot for the region and priced far beyond the modest means of the average citizen. Now, in the summer of 1972, Bokassa turned his anger toward the United States. The documents in his hands outlined America's intention to oust his government by force. The far-fetched proposition fell well within the worldview of an African despot whose own path to power included a violent overthrow of the government. The U.S. ambassador, in an effort to counter the false but diplomatically troublesome accusation, turned to the CIA for assistance. Within TSD was a small team of forensic scientists who operated a Questioned Documents Laboratory, QDL, primarily used to detect forgeries created by the KGB's Active Measures element of the Soviet propaganda machine. The QDL also examined questionable foreign documents to support counterintelligence operations. Although QDL experts received little prominence in a division known primarily for its gadgets, disguises, and concealments, their expertise could be of value in this case. TSD dispatched QDL examiner Dr. David Crown to Bangui, the Central African Empire's capital city, in July 1972. The U.S. ambassador knew the documents were bogus, but confided to Crown that he had been unable to persuade Bokassa. It would be up to the QDL examiner to convince the ego-driven and paranoid ruler that the documents were, in fact, forgeries. Pointing out the blatant inaccuracies would be a simple matter under more ordinary circumstances. Even to the untrained eye, the language and linguistic flaws in the documents were obvious. The letterhead was emblazoned in gaudy green and red, hardly an approved style of Washington's sedate bureaucracy. The name of the supposed agency that generated the plot, Communications in Superior Science Activities, NSC Fairbanks, the White House, the State Department, the Defense Department, Washington 25, D.C., was a ridiculous jumble of terms and government entities and included an apparent reference to the CIA's highway signs along the George Washington Parkway northwest of Washington, D.C. There, the fictional agency was headed by a Richard Brown.